Live from Cap Radio here in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. And this morning on the show, we're going to dig into some issues that are important to the LGBTQ communities, including a push in Congress to pass the Equality Act. Also, the mayor of Long Beach believes his city has experienced a recent very visible hate crime against the gay community. We'll speak live with him about that. And we'll dive into a new true crime podcast about a Northern California serial killer from the 1970s who exclusively targeted gay men. We'll hear from the host, who's also a longtime reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. But first up this morning, we're going to explore the idea of providing people with a universal basic income. Several Northern California cities are now exploring the idea that first really made headlines a couple of years ago in Stockton under then-Mayor Michael Tubbs. In that program, randomly selected residents received $500 per month for 2 years with no strings attached. It also did not rely on taxpayer funding. Independent researchers recently found that the program was a success. So now the Bay Area communities of Oakland, San Francisco, also in Marin County, they're all presenting versions of this idea. Former Mayor Tubbs joins us today to help us understand the movement. Welcome back to Insight, Mayor. It's nice to see you again.
So good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so first off, walk us through the report that came out earlier this month. What did it find regarding your basic income program there in Stockton?
Well, Randall, what the report illustrates is something that those who struggle economically know far too well. Number one, $500 was not enough for people to stop working. And if you're listening, turn up your radios and make sure you get this point. The $500 actually allowed people to work more. It allowed people to transition from part-time work to full-time work at two times the rate than those who did not receive the guaranteed income. And oftentimes, Randall, people wonder why. Well, it's because if you're living paycheck to paycheck in an hourly job with no paid time off, it is very risky and expensive, even to take one day off of work to interview for a job that may pay better, that may have better benefits, because it's not a guarantee. Although at the end of the month, you know, your bills are guaranteed. The second thing we found is that the $500 acted as a financial vaccine and allowed people to cope with income volatility. So that when the emergency happened, when the car broke down, when someone got sick, when someone needed help, they were able to absorb the shocks of life in a way that they weren't able to before. And then finally, we found that the $500 was enough to lower stress, to lower anxiety, to lower negative health outcomes. And in fact, comparable to clinical trials of Prozac, which suggests to me that so much of the stress and anxiety and depression we see may actually be triggered by economic insecurity. And I think it's because of the strength of that data, which again, I think is intuitive for folks who actually know people who struggle, for folks who actually are working at hourly jobs, that it's not surprising that if you give folks just a little bit of help, a springboard, they can really take advantage of opportunity.
That's stunning. Psychologically, that $500 check had similar effects to the clinical trials of Prozac.
Which is incredible. And it doesn't mean medicine's not important, but it does mean that when we talk about financial health, we're talking about mental health and overall health. And it's consistent with what we know about poverty being one of the social determinants of health. It's consistent with what we've seen with COVID-19, with communities who have the least amount of money having the highest rates of COVID infections are most likely to die from the disease. So it matches with what we're seeing. And I'm excited that so many mayors are taking the charge and illustrate that this is a policy that works and something that we need in our state and in our country.
Yeah. Mayor Tubbs, you mentioned one of the issues that critics have with the program, and that is the thought that it might eliminate the incentive to work. But that runs contrary, as you said. The research shows that quite the opposite happened. Another concern is that this money might endanger certain existing safety net programs. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, I've been crystal clear since we announced in October 2017, before folks even knew what the guaranteed income or basic income was, that in my conception, it's not a replacement for the existing social safety net. It's an enhancement. And if we want to cut government programs, I think there's a lot of places we can cut. We can cut the Space Force, for example. We can cut our bloated on Pentagon budget. We could reverse the 2017 Trump tax cuts. There's a bunch of places we will cut. I just think it's not prudent to help folks who are struggling economically by cutting the programs that are currently designed to help them. And I'll say it another way, Randall. I think if I don't need $1,000 a month and my neighbor does, and my neighbor also needs sort of maybe a housing voucher, maybe food stamps, how is it just or how is it fair that we take away what they need for both of us to get the same thing? And in fact, that would actually leave my neighbor in a relatively worse position compared to me than they were before, right? Because so I definitely think we should have a conversation about government waste. And I think we waste so much money on tax cuts. We make so much money on the military. And I think if we legalize cannabis federally, that's another revenue stream that could be used to support something like this.
Yeah, and you talk about tax-funded programs like the Space Force or the Pentagon and those sorts of programs. But your program there in Stockton did not rely on taxpayer money. Do you believe that that can be a model for a much larger version of this? Or at some point, will there have to be taxpayer participation?
No, 1,000,000%. I think philanthropy, like charity is injustice. And I think the fact that I had to go to philanthropists to fund something like this suggests a system failure. Like, there's no reason why I should have to beg somebody for money for my residents to pay, afford their rent and afford to eat and afford to health care. That's just ridiculous. And I think it's true for all the mayors. So I think we're piloting the idea to leave no excuse. You can't say there's no data. We can combat these lies about people not wanting to work or people spending money on drugs and alcohol. We can provide stories that really show people that if Black people get help, that helps everyone. If white people get help, if Asian people get help, if we all get help, everyone does better. And I think it has to be a federal policy. And in the interim, we know we have to be incremental and illustrate and do baby steps. And we can't wait for Washington to act, but we have to force Washington to act. And I think the pilots helped do that.
Was there any data in this research that ran contrary to your goals with the program?
I think, well, honestly, Randall, my goal was just to do it. There's been so much rhetoric about people and why people struggle. And I was like, I'm agnostic. Let's just see what happens. So I think what was most surprising to me actually was the amount of impact, particularly on mental health. It's heartbreaking to me that so many people, and it was also shocking to me was how something as small as an economic floor allowed people to be better parents, allow people to be better partners, allow people to be better neighbors, which is what government's designed to do. Because I had no idea that so many people were struggling as parents because they didn't have money. They were stressed. They were anxious. I just had no idea that like the health impacts were something I did not anticipate being so pronounced. Because only, again, $500 for a year. And I'm really excited for next year when we see the data from 2020, when we see the data from the COVID year, because I truly believe a guaranteed income is pandemic preparedness, because we live in a time of pandemics, particularly in this state, and allowing people to build economic resilience allows them to do better when the pandemic happens. So I'm excited to see that data to really, again, illustrate how this is something that's a necessity given the times we live in.
Your program started in February of 2019. It was a two-year program, which means it just ended. What do we know about the families that were receiving this money and how that ceasing of that monthly paycheck might be affecting them?
Well, I think one of the critiques of the research that I actually agree with is because it was finite. People may have made slightly different decisions than they would if they knew it was ongoing. But I think that's a good thing, because we saw people position themselves for when the money would run out. So they were getting full-time jobs. They were saving money. They were paying off debt. They were paying for, because the thing is, Randall, it's small things that keep people trapped in poverty or economic insecurity, and it's so expensive. It's like the transmission going out and that compounding. It's not getting your dental work done for $300, and it's compounding, becomes a bigger issue for $1,000. It's not being able to do those little things in a moment. So anecdotally, and from what I read in the research, so many of the folks were smart about, okay, let me use this money for immediate things to build a foundation. And when it's over, I'm in a better position. I have a better job. I have more stable hours. My kids have the tutoring. I have the health things figured out. I have some money saved for a rainy day.
Yeah. When you set up this 2-year plan, you could have never envisioned that the second half of it would be clouded with this pandemic, which really gives you a whole separate lens to see how this $500 works, which is why you're excited about the 2020 numbers.
Yeah, well, it was really the pandemic that took me from just someone interested in the concept and waiting for the research to a full-blown evangelist, because I heard from folks who were saying while they were waiting for EDD, that $500 was a lifeline. I heard from folks that said they were able to shelter in place and stay at home because they had the $500. And if they didn't have the $500, they would have went to work and maybe infected people. And I realized that this was such an important part of a pandemic response. And I think we've seen that, Randall, with kind of the federal response. Like, yeah. 3 years ago, in 2017, when I said we're going to do a guaranteed income, people said you can't give people money. In 2019, in 2020, and 2021, you had even Republicans saying, let's not send people money. The debates about how much money and how often to send, but even this bipartisan agreement that we have to give people an income floor. And that's just amazing to see. And that's why we have over 50 mayors across this country, including many in California, who are signing up to be part of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income and continue to push the conversation.
Yeah, you founded the organization Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, and a quick check of the membership that you just mentioned shows mayors on board from throughout the nation, with some concentrations I noticed in Southern California. In fact, we'll hear from Long Beach Mayor Robert Garcia a little later in the show, and another concentration in the Northeast, and then, you know, a smattering of cities elsewhere. It's a diverse group, though, racially, genders, ages, but how about ideologically? Are there any Republicans or independents on board?
Randall, we do have an independent. The mayor of San Antonio, my good friend Ron, is on board. And talking to a couple Republican mayors as well, because what's interesting is the data tells us, the polling says, the majority of Republicans, the majority of independents, and the majority of Democrats all support at least reoccurring checks. But I would even say, even in the sort of the geographic diversity, you have some mayors who are Democrats in the South or Democrats where they are, who would be considered quite conservative in San Francisco or Oakland or Southern California. So we don't have sort of registered Republican mayors, but we do have mayors that are more moderate, that are more kind of fiscally conservative, that wouldn't consider themselves progressive and actually took a leap of faith to join and be a part, because they see the need.
Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs about the success of his city's universal basic income program and how other communities in Northern California are now experimenting with the idea. And I want you to tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in the Bay Area, Mayor Tubbs. How much have you been leaned on, I guess, for advice from these places that are starting these programs?
Oh, I spend the majority of my time as the chair of Mayors for Guaranteed Income. So I'm in conversations with mayors and their staffs in the Bay Area and across this country about this topic all the time. So so incredibly proud of the leadership of Mayor Schaaf in Oakland. I'm so proud of the leadership of Mayor Brown in Compton. I'm so proud of the leadership of Mayor Garcia in Long Beach, Mayor Garcetti in LA, my sister, the mayor of West Hollywood. So it's proud of the leadership of Mayor Breed in San Francisco, and San Francisco is interesting because there's so many of them are community-based. So you have the Abundant Mothers Project, who's running in San Francisco. You have sort of the announcement they made about the guaranteed income for artists. So I spend a lot of time with mayors and their staffs just talking about sort of, we actually just had a meeting with Senator Padilla about kind of California, this conversation we're having now about kind of California cities and guaranteed income. Had a conversation with Senator Casey of Pennsylvania, with some mayors in Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago. We had a meeting with the White House National Economic Council and the Domestic Policy Council with Mayor Garcetti and Mayor Bottoms of LA and Atlanta and Mayor Carter of St. Paul. So we've been in conversations with a lot of mayors, helping them design their pilots. I have an amazing staff. We have the young woman who ran the Stockton pilot. She's kind of directing the network. So she's on the ground providing technical assistance to cities. We have my former executive assistant at City Hall, who's a deputy director working with all the city staff. So we are full speed ahead.
Yeah,
and
it's really
very hard to get
it's
on
really
these
taking
up.
Off. Mayor, I want to talk to you about something that could potentially be a fly in the ointment. The Reason Foundation, which is a libertarian think tank, the number one story on its website this morning at reason.com is the basic income issue. But the headline says the programs in Marin and Oakland exclude white people, then questioning whether that's even legal. Can you see how racial exclusion could create a wedge issue for your work, maybe derailing some efforts?
Yeah, well, I would say I'm not running the pilots in Oakland and in Marin County. So that was a decision that the elected leadership made in terms of what's best for their community. But I also think it's false to call it racially exclusionary. I think it's racially intentional. And I say that because Mayor Schaaf has been very clear that there is a wide wealth gap in Oakland between white people and between everything else. And that wealth gap is unacceptable. And as the elected official of a city that's majority not white, she decided that she wanted to marry guaranteed income with a conversation about the wealth gap. And that's why in the pilot that can't get to everybody, she decided to focus her resources on the people who need it the most. And to me, that sounds like using data to drive decision-making. To me, that sounds consistent with kind of the civil rights origins of guaranteed income from Dr. King and the Black Panthers. And for me, it seems like kind of courageous leadership, because oftentimes people talk about the issue, but whenever you do anything, I mean, people were upset when I did the guaranteed income for everyone and assumed that it was just for Black people, right? So I think the issue isn't sort of the targeting. I think the issue is just the pervasive racism we have in our country when we have literally 400 years of exclusion from housing loans, from wealth, from being paid for labor for 300 years. But one pilot with 600 people that focuses not on the folks who need it the most in the community, in a neighborhood, East Oakland, that's majority not white, and that's the cry of racism, it's completely ridiculous.
It's going to be fascinating to watch all of these programs move forward. Former mayor of Stockton and champion for expanding the idea of a universal basic income, Michael Tubbs, a pleasure speaking with you today.
Anytime, Randall. Thank you, brother.
All right, up next, we dig into some issues facing the LGBTQ communities, including a recent high-profile fire in one California city that some believe was targeted at the gay community, and a look at the Equality Act in Congress. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, right here at Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation today is focused on some issues important to those who fall under the LGBTQ umbrella. Despite some significant setbacks, actually, in California's history regarding the treatment of this community, for the most part, the state has, on several levels, led the way with gay rights. Today, Californians enjoy several protections that are not necessarily provided in some other parts of the country. So there is an effort currently in Congress to standardize these rights on a nationwide scale. The legislation lawmakers are considering is called the Equality Act. Managing Director of Equality California, Tony Huang, joins us now to help us better understand the importance of this piece of legislation. And thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Randall.
So, Tony, let's talk about the Equality Act. Why is it needed now, in your view?
So the Equality Act, also known as H.R. 5, is a landmark piece of civil rights legislation that would update existing federal laws, specifically the 1964 Civil Rights Act, to protect people from discrimination based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, just like other protected classes such as race, color, religion, or national origin. The Equality Act would explicitly ban LGBTQ plus discrimination in almost every area of daily life, including employment, housing, education, credit, jury service, and other areas, and extend sex discrimination protections to public accommodations and other federally funded programs. Mm.
Could it almost be considered an amendment?
Exactly. So what this is doing is not, it's just expanding the existing Civil Rights Act to include specifically LGBTQ plus people.
Mm-hmm. Where do we stand with the legislation right now? Congress is on what's considered their spring break this week.
Exactly. So on February 25th of this year, the Equality Act passed the U.S. House of Representatives, led by Speaker Pelosi, by a bipartisan vote of 224 versus 206. Mm-hmm. And all 42 California House Democrats were the original co-sponsors. A few weeks ago, testimony on the bill was heard in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where anti-LGBTQ plus extremists like Senator Ted Cruz and James Lankford spewed hateful and unfounded claims against the LGBTQ plus community. But in order to pass the U.S. Senate, the bill must overcome the filibuster, an archaic tool that we know has been used to block civil rights protections for decades with the support of 60 senators.
Mm-hmm. So that's the big issue, is in the Senate with the filibuster.
Exactly. You know, some have encouraged the Senate to reform the filibuster in order to pass the Equality Act and other bold pieces of legislation that enjoy bipartisan support from an overwhelming majority of voters. Specifically, 83% of Americans believe that the Equality Act should pass.
What, 83%?
Exactly. 83% of Americans, even a majority of Republicans, as well as a majority of voters in every single state in America, believe that the Equality Act should be passed. You know, when we're out there talking about this piece of legislation, people are surprised that, you know, going into a restaurant, you could be denied service because you're LGBTQ plus in 29 states across this country, or be fired, or be denied housing. So what we're asking, you know, Congress to do is join the majority of Americans to support the Equality Act so that President Biden can sign this bill into law.
So more than half the states, did you say 29?
29 states.
Correct. 29 states. What does that equal out to population-wise? Like, do you know what it is? Like, 4 in 10 U.S. residents face this?
About half of Americans live in states where there does not currently exist explicit LGBTQ protections for LGBTQ folks.
Yeah. So California's history with LGBTQ rights is mixed. but where we stand right now, would you consider that good in terms of civil rights?
Exactly. You know, we are lucky here to live in California, where Equality California has partnered with so many great champions in the state legislature, so that we have the most comprehensive set of civil rights protections for LGBTQ plus people in the country. But we didn't get there overnight, and we're not done fighting. You know, our work fighting for LGBTQ plus civil rights and social justice doesn't stop at the California border. You know, we believe that the state you live in, you shouldn't determine whether or not you have basic civil rights protections. That's why we're working with the California delegation or national partners to ensure that the Equality Act gets passed and signed into law.
Yeah, and you say it doesn't stop at the California border. CAP Radio is heard in a significant chunk of Nevada, Reno, Carson City, portions of Lake Tahoe. So where does Nevada stand when it comes to gay rights?
Yeah, so we're lucky to have an affiliate out in Nevada, Silver State Equality, where we've been working with our partners and the Nevada delegation out there. And luckily, you know, due to some great longtime advocates out in Nevada, Nevada actually has strong civil rights protections as well, similar to California. You know, there are some specific areas where, you know, additional work can be done. But again, you know, the work doesn't stop just at, you know, the California-Nevada border. We want to ensure that, you know, there are strong, comprehensive sets of civil rights protections for LGBTQ people nationwide. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Equality Act is so important to get passed and signed into law.
Tony, there might be a lot of people that find this surprising that it's even needed. There have been some pretty landmark Supreme Court cases in recent years. And, you know, the average person who's not affected by directly affected by these rights might think, isn't this settled law?
Yeah. So, you know, last year we had a really landmark ruling with the Bostock versus Clayton County Supreme Court case, which ruled that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 applied narrowly to LGBTQ plus workers when it comes to barring discrimination on the basis of sex. But again, that is specifically for employment non-discrimination for LGBTQ plus workers. So that's why we're asking that Congress step up and ensure that the Bostock decision applies to all forms of public life, including housing, public accommodations. So it includes, you know, all those facets of life for both sexual orientation and gender identity, not specifically just to employment.
Yeah. Managing Director. Oh, I should ask, what's the final timeline on this when the Senate resumes? Do they have to take it up within a certain period of time?
You know, I think we're looking, you know, hopefully by 2022, given sort of the next round of elections, to ensure, you know, we have a pretty narrow window. You know, I think that's why it's crucial that, you know, as a broader community, we are talking about filibuster reform, because getting to 60 votes will be tough. But we want to make sure that the Senate knows that, you know, 83% of Americans are there with us, and that we signed this in the first 100 days of the Biden administration.
Managing Director of Equality California, Tony Huang, thank you for the update on the Equality Act.
Thank you so much, Randall.
And you are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're discussing some issues that are important to the LGBTQ communities out there. Last week, a prominent lifeguard tower in the city of Long Beach burned down. I mean, it's gone. It's not just damaged. It might not have made any headlines had it not been, or had it been, just an ordinary tower. This structure, however, was painted in the colors of the rainbow flag last summer to mark the 50th anniversary of the first ever Pride March in the U.S. That took place in New York. Residents of the Long Beach area who regularly jog on this path adjacent to this stretch of beach tell me in a short period of time, this lifeguard tower had quickly become a symbol for the LGBTQ community and was much loved by many of the residents in the area. Well, the cause of the fire is still under investigation, but the mayor of Long Beach, Robert Garcia, thinks it was arson and it was a hate crime. Mayor Garcia joins us now with more on his take regarding this incident. Nice to have you here, Mayor.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So what led you to the pretty quick conclusion that it was a crime?
I mean, look, I think obviously this is still officially under investigation, and I think that's important for folks to know. But I think also the facts are also laid out pretty clear. We would look back. There has not been a fire incident at a lifeguard station in Long Beach. We went all the way back to the 1950s. So over 70 years where there has not been a fire. And that's because these stations are really hard to just catch on fire for no reason. In addition to that, you know, just the one lifeguard station that was painted in pride colors just in the last year was the one that completely burned to the sand is beyond some strange coincidence. And yeah. So I think that in talking to our fire guys and the folks that were there, it's pretty clear that this was an incident that was done by an individual or a group of individuals. And we know that while Long Beach is a very progressive city as it relates to gay rights and equality, there are still people out there that are hateful and that you know, engage in these types of activities. And so I'm certain of what the issue is here, and we're moving forward and making sure that we rebuild it bigger and better.
Prior to the pandemic, Long Beach had one of the largest pride celebrations in the state. Does it not?
Oh, we do, and we continue to do. It's one of the largest in the country. So Long Beach also has a very large LGBTQ plus community. So it's kind of one of the well-known loved things about our city. And so this has been the lifeguard station has been a big symbol for not just the gay community, but quite frankly for everyone. I mean, it's a pretty popular photo spot. Folks stop there, and people have gotten married on it. And so it was really a shame to see what happened.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's a progressive community. You're leading the community and were voted in as an out politician.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard, obviously, when I ran for mayor now 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I was certainly out and certainly had my fair share of negativity from some folks and homophobia from people that weren't used to someone that was gay running for office. But the community, you know, supported me and reelected me, and we're a progressive city. So it does personally, I personally am both saddened and angered that someone would do this in our city. And it's important, I think, for us, and the community has rallied around this issue and been very vocal in some protests and some actions that this does not stand in our city.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Garcia, how has the community responded to this? What are you hearing?
Well, I think there's been some really good affirmation of what Long Beach and Valleys are all about. I mean, Long Beach traditionally has really led the way on LGBTQ plus issues. We're one of the first cities to do domestic partnership benefits. We're one of the first cities to do trans inclusive healthcare in our city. Early on, and we were one of the top 10 cities in the country in passing LGBTQ plus rights for gay couples. This has been, you know, decades and decades of work. So I think the reaction has been kind of affirming our place as a leader within the gay community from a community perspective, and then just making it clear that whoever did these types of activity and this type of crime is just not welcome in our city. They're certainly not part of our broader community, you know, and we suspect that whoever did this is obviously seeing the reaction to the action from the city, and we're going to make sure that when the new tower comes in, it's well protected, and I think the community will rally around it as well.
So there will be a new tower coming in, and I've seen a lot of posts on Twitter and on Facebook that are saying, build it better, bigger and better, like make this one really stand out.
Bigger, I always say bigger and better and gayer.
And gayer. I don't know how you could make it any gayer, because that was,
I mean, it was pretty gay, but I think just leave it to us. We'll figure out a way.
Mayor, help put this into context nationally. I just the other day it was featured on CNN. So clearly this is sparking interest beyond Long Beach, beyond California.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's been a lot of national interest on this. I think it just kind of struck a chord. I think oftentimes we think that we've made so much progress on LGBTQ plus rights. And we have. I'm fortunate. I'm given the right to marry the person I love. And there's so many rights that were afforded. But this, I think, incident's a reminder that there is a lot of folks out there that still have, hate in their hearts for gay people, for the LGBTQ plus people, for people that are different, that are diverse. And that's something that we have to remember to ensure that people are safe, to hold each other accountable, and to remind us of all the work ahead. I mean, you just talked about the Equality Act. And the Equality Act is critical in passing across this country. Trans people in this country are greatly discriminated against, and there's a lot of work to do in that area. And many states don't have the same protections that we have here in California. So I think it's an unfortunate reminder of all the work that's ahead of us, even in more progressive places like California and Long Beach.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a voice with some of the, I know that the congressional delegation from California, including the two senators, are behind the Equality Act, but are you able to weigh in on that and express that you'd like to see it passed?
Yeah, we've weighed in on it. The city's taking an official position supporting the Equality Act, and I have as well. And I think the issue with the Equality Act is not our delegation here, but Republicans in the Senate. And so I think that there's just a lot of work to do there. And Equality California and others are right. I think the filibuster is a huge impediment to just securing equal rights for people in our country, for average Americans. And so we have a lot of work to do there. And I think that the LGBTQ plus community are pretty united in filibuster reform or to abolish it. I mean, that's a pretty clear message. We're ready for the Equality Act to pass. And no offense, but a handful of senators, 8, 9, 10 U.S. senators should not stand in the way for millions of Americans to have basic rights.
With vaccinations on the rise, there was just a story on NPR earlier today about how that number keeps edging up, the number of Americans who say they want to get vaccinated. And with the state opening up to different levels, L.A. County is what color now? Red?
Yeah, red. We're going to be in orange actually pretty soon.
When do you foresee events like Long Beach's Pride celebration returning to where you can actually have a crowd?
I mean, that is the question. We don't really know that yet. I mean, I think a lot of it is dependent on what's going to happen over the next, really 30, 60 days. If vaccinations become widely available, like they're expected to be in the next few weeks, I think you are going to see some shifts in gatherings. We just got to make sure people get vaccinated. But it's certainly not going to happen in the next couple months. I think that we're still months away from larger types of events and gatherings. I hope and I'm hopeful that that this fall we're going to start seeing some of these events and conventions kind of coming back. I think that this summer is going to be kind of the where we really extinguish this as a pandemic. And so you just got to get through this summer. Get vaccinated, keep people safe, make sure people are inoculated. And then I hope that, by the fall, we can return to some, semblance of normalcy in our cities and in our country.
Finally, I want to pull a thread from a little earlier in the show. We spoke with former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs, and I see that you are part of the Mayors for Guaranteed Income organization. Do you foresee Long Beach starting up one of these programs like we're now seeing in San Francisco, Oakland, and Marin County?
Yeah, we've actually already started. So we've run two small pilots already. The one we're running right now is for artists. So we're giving artists $500 a month, up to $3,000 for 6 months, and to just give them additional support during the pandemic. And it's going to about 150 artists in the city, either performers, musicians. And so all the pilots as part of the MGI group are all different. So the artist one is being run right now. And then we're right now planning for a much larger guaranteed income pilot program that'll probably happen later this summer or the fall, which we're planning for right now. And that is going to be also targeted to lower income folks in our city. And then, of course, the most important part of this is the research. We're going to partner with a university, put some research together, and then package it all as part of our pilot program. So we're excited. And Michael Tubbs is a great friend and has done a great job of organizing the mayor.
Are you partnering with Cal State Long Beach?
We are.
Yeah. Long Beach Mayor Robert Garcia, we very much appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us, and best of luck with the investigation, and even more luck with rebuilding that tower bigger and better. And Gare.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Right. Still ahead, we'll hear about a cold case serial killer who targeted gay men in San Francisco back in the 1970s, and what progress is being made with that case. We'll speak with the host of a new podcast that is very popular nationally. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. In the 1970s, there was a serial killer terrorizing San Francisco, but few people have heard of him, and some wonder whether police didn't prioritize solving the cases because of who was being targeted, the city's gay population. Kevin Fagan is a longtime reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle and has spent years researching the killer, known as the Doodler, and also getting to know more about his victims. The nickname comes from the fact that he would draw or sketch the men he targeted prior to slaying them. Now, Kevin has taken all of the information he's learned and is sharing it through a new podcast. I recently spoke with Kevin about it and started by asking him about his passion for the topic and what drove him to give the Doodler so much attention.
Well, I've done a lot of murder stories over the years, and this one had an extra element to it of the whole of being rooted in a period of amazing oppression against LGBTQ people and the community pushing for its rights. Gay liberation was starting to flourish then. I mean, there were a lot of efforts, you know, dating back to the 50s in particular. But in the early 70s, the push was on. But at the time that the Doodler was killing people, there were still sodomy laws on the books, still cross-dressing laws on the books. And as I started doing my interviews, I was just really struck by the bravery and the trauma of those days. Drag queens, because one of the victims, of course, of the Doodler was Jay Stevens, this beautiful, wonderful drag queen who was killed and left in Golden Gate Park. And when I was talking to his friends, they said, yeah, we'd walk down the streets and people throw stuff at us. They'd beat us up. Our friends were getting stabbed to death. I mean, it was like a much more violent version of the AIDS horror that happened in the 80s. And there was one particular time where I went in January, just before COVID shut everything down, I went to a wonderful drag show at Aunt Charlie's, where these 70-year-old drag queens who remembered Jay back in the day were doing their thing, and I loved it. And the perspective that they gave me just put me back to that time. I mean, I was young in the early 70s, but I remember the feeling of society. It was bigoted. I quote Art Agnos, a former mayor, in this thing, saying it was Neanderthal times, and to some extent, he's right. So I really wanted to to present this in a way that put it into perspective, that these were five men who were killed and forgotten and barely noticed at the time, even Jay. And a lot of that had to do with the bigotry of the times. And I felt like I had a responsibility to help set that right somehow with illumination that you can do as a journalist. And it's just, it really got a hold of me.
I'm glad you pointed out Jay, because I think he helps illustrate what the times were like, because here's somebody who was in the process of making the transition to the mainstream, you know, performing on stage at Finocchio's, which was one of these bars in North Beach that had a pretty mainstream crowd of straight people. And even someone at that level of notoriety being murdered in this way by what police later determined was a serial killer didn't grab the headlines the way some of the other murders that were taking place in the city did.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot gone wrong in recent years in our country, in our world. But one thing that strikes me as a hopeful thing is that if Jay had been killed today, we'd be all over it. Front page news. We have LGBTQ staff at the Chronicle. There's LGBTQ police officers. It's an advanced world in that respect. I mean, it's not as far as we need to go yet. We're not all, you know, all cool and groovy in every way possible. But he would get a lot of notice today. In fact, these other killings would get a lot of notice. Once the pattern began emerging, we would be all over it. But, you know, no one was all over it the way that they should have been back then.
Yeah. And then there's the whole other aspect that you've got the Zodiac going on, and you've got the zebra killings, which I had forgotten about. I grew up in the Bay Area, and I'd forgotten about the zebra killings. They just happened to coincide right as this was all happening, and it took away a lot of resources. Even if there were police that wanted to work on this Doodler case, they were being pushed over to the zebra situation.
Oh, yeah, the zebra killers, you know, killed about 15 people. I mean, that's a huge body count at a time that was already pretty bad. I mean, there were 130 murders every year in San Francisco back then, and it had a smaller population. Now you have about 40 or 50 every year. And it's, you know, the homicide squad, they had 16 guys chasing after all these murders. Yeah, and the Zodiac was still sending spooky letters. Patty Hearst kidnapping happened. The 70s were kind of off the hook. And serial killing wasn't really a known term in a wide way at the time. But it was becoming that because of people like the Doodler and the Zodiac and the other kind of psychos that were starting to kill people they didn't know.
There was only so much Carl Malden could take on a weekly basis back then for people old enough to remember Streets of San Francisco.
I know.
So because there's so much information, so much history, how do you choose what to include along those lines?
Boy, that is tough. I have a wonderful script writer at Neon Hum named Tanner Robbins. And he's sharp, and he lays down the scripts, and then we all go at it and rewrite them and, you know, add things. But he keeps a really good sense of where we should go on this.
Stopping you and saying you're going a little far afield here. You know, we gotta bring it back.
Yeah, because I always like including more information. For instance, there's this one weird angle on the Zodiac that inserts itself a little later on in the episodes. You'll see it in the story, but it came out of the episodes because it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't enough time. You got to keep these things to a half hour. You could go an hour each, but frankly, I don't really want to listen to a whole hour of a podcast. I like the half hour format.
Yeah, I could listen to an hour. I have to tell you, every time I hear it's winding up, I'm like, oh, I wanted it to go longer. Kevin, the harm this person caused so many people, and the friends and families of those people, despite being nearly a half century ago, is still fresh and painful for those who you speak with. Perhaps, I don't know, kept in that state because there's never been a sense of accountability for the crimes.
Yeah, whenever someone is murdered, one of the common things that get said that, you know, I drop it into a story now and then, but it almost becomes cliche, is that if you're killed at 17, you are forever 17. you know, and Jay is forever 27. Joe Kavanaugh is forever 50. My partner on this thing is Mike Taylor. He and I worked at the Chronicle together until he retired about 10 years ago. We covered the Unabomber, 9/11, you know, a bunch of awful things together. And between us, we found people all over the world that were related to these victims, because no one had really reached out to these families. That was another great tragedy of the time. There's a way of grieving when there's a high profile murder or just any murder, when there's some notice to it. There wasn't notice to these murders the way they should have gotten.
Some family members did not even realize that their loved one had been killed by a serial killer.
Yeah. Jay's sister didn't. And she was a delightful person. Oh my God. Wonderful to talk about. She performed with Jay. Jay and Jay's partner, Steve Miller, in the act, took on Melissa, and they became the Wonder Sisters. It was terrific. She sang a little bit for me, you know, and I'm sorry that came out of the podcast, but I said, well, what did you sing? She goes, come on, baby, let the good times roll. And she still has it, you know. She could still do it, and it's still fresh for her. But she did not know her brother had been killed by a serial killer until just a couple of years ago. And I found that amazing. And the people we found in Germany, Sweden, Canada, Netherlands, we had to scrape all over the world to find relatives of these folks, because, boy, that many years goes by, it layers things over, and there's still pain. When we took the scab off on this history with some of these people, some didn't want to talk. Actually, a lot of them didn't even want to be named. There was pain from the loss, but also still this lingering feeling from the early 70s that there was a gay person in the family who had been killed, and there was a little bit of unease about that. All these years later, in these modern times, 2021.
I don't want you to give anything away in the episode that will be released this week or future episodes, but do we know, is there a sense that the killer was likely gay himself?
There's a sense that, and I think I wrote this in a story I did a couple of years ago, that he was struggling with his sexual identity. And that's, you know, it's pretty rare, but if you're already torqued and unhinged and you're struggling with it and you want to act out your rage and your confusion, the one way to do that, if you're really off the hook, is to go kill people. There's a sense that that is probably what happened.
Is there DNA evidence that's still available that they could use some of the modern techniques like they used to catch the Golden State Killer?
So with DNA, you'll learn later on in the episodes, but I'll just say that DNA is not the magic bullet that everyone thinks it is. It's really old evidence in this case, and we get into that in the later episodes.
Kevin Fagan is a journalist at the San Francisco Chronicle and the host of the Doodler podcast, which is coming out with episode 4 this week. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate you paying attention to this, because it's important to me, and I think it's important for everyone to think about.
And again, that conversation was pre-recorded. The newest episode actually dropped this morning, if you want to hear it. And I should mention that investigators do believe that the doodler could likely be alive still. So that's another thread that they pull through the podcast. Currently, all Apple podcasts, all podcasts, not a category like true crime, but all podcasts, the doodler sits at number 7 this morning nationally. So it's a very popular podcast, and it's very good. Okay, that does it for Insight for today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. And thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor RM Sarkissian for always getting the show on the air. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta. Our technical director is Mark Jones. The engineer today is Devin Cortan. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I am Randall White. Thank you for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow, Wednesday, when we learn more about the vaccine rollout and how some are cutting in line and fraud by those who want to fake vaccine documents. Make it a great day.